So, the first thing I'll say is that Saturday was the autumnal equinox. The actual moment of equinox was at 6:54 p.m. Pacific time. And this is a big day in many ways. On the equinox, of course, the word equal day, equal night, means that there's 12 hours a day and 12 hours of night and on every point on the planet. And so it's this planet-wide event. It is one of the 2 days of the year, the other is the other equinox, when the sun rises due east and sets due west. And for the next 6 months in the Northern Hemisphere, the nights are going to be longer than the days. And the points of sunrise and sunset are going to be south of east and south of west. And in fact, they're going to drift and drift further and further south as the day gets shorter. And then at a certain point, the sun will stand still. And sun standing still, that's the etymological root of solstice. And then it will move back for the other equinox. If you've been noticing right now, say from last week to this week and then to next week, the length of daylight is dropping like a stone right now. Like going from a week ago to a week from now, we easily lose an hour of daylight. Just like we're losing, chunks like 4 and 5 minutes at a time. The shape of the cycle of length of the day is this kind of shape. It's what's known in math as a sinusoidal cycle. And the point of the equinox is the place where the slope is the steepest. And so at the autumnal equinox, day is shrinking and night is expanding at the greatest rate, and then the opposite at the vernal equinox in spring. Saturday was also dawn at the South Pole. And the South Pole will have 6 months of uninterrupted sunlight. It's also dusk at the North Pole, and the North Pole will have six months of uninterrupted nighttime. Do you think it's dark here? And so all this happens on the equinox. It is a planet-wide event. It's so funny, because in modern society, you can not even notice it, and then people notice daylight savings time when that comes, and that's just, we're playing a game with ourselves. Like, nothing in the world changes, we just rearrange the clocks. And so it got me thinking about the equinox and what it means to cross into the dark part of the year. And one of the things it reminded me of course, is the hero's journey. And an essential part of the hero's journey is the crossing into the darkness. Sometimes the hero's journey is described as a circle, where he starts out at the top, and he goes down to a lower realm, and he gets down to a belly of the beast or something like that, and gets some treasure, and then brings it back. And so, in at least some versions of the hero story, say the hero will cross into the dark region, he'll encounter some sort of beast, say a dragon or something. And inevitably the dragon is guarding some incredible treasure, the dragon is often guarding some beautiful woman, And so of course the hero slays the dragon, but it's very interesting, slays the dragon, but also has to incorporate something of the dragon, whether it's making some sort of garment from it, or, very typically, sticking his hand in, and then the blood burns his hand, and he puts it in his mouth to soothe his hand, and he winds up tasting the blood, and somehow integrates the energy of the dragon. In some versions, he tastes the blood, and that allows him to hear the song of nature, allows him to understand what the birds are saying, that kind of thing. And then, of course, he gets all the gold, and he marries the beautiful women, and they live happily ever after. So that's the hero story. That's the basic template. Now, what does this mean if we look at it from a more Buddhist perspective. In a more Buddhist perspective, the realm of light is the realm of awareness, the realm of attention. There's this powerful connection between attention and light. That's precisely why we call the state of complete attention enlightenment. And correspondingly, darkness is any place where anything outside of our awareness, any place our awareness doesn't go. And so that's interesting. That's certainly the unknown. And it's not so much the unknown like the like more a head-centered, like an academic unknown, like say a discipline I've never studied before. Like it's not so much cognitive unknown. It's much more the unknown about being human. It's certainly an experience I've had, and I'm sure we've all had it, where there's just, say, a situation of some kind unfolding, and maybe I'm in this situation, or I'm just witnessing this situation, and then someone else, it might be a friend, it might be a perfect stranger, reacts in a way, or acts in a way in that situation, and I think, I never would have acted that way. You know? And it might be much better, it might be much worse, but it's another way of being human. You know, there are 7 billion different ways to be human. And many of them are things we can't even imagine. You know, and so part of that is the unknown. So it's the unknown both of the unknown that's external in the world as well as internal. You know, in other words, I put myself in a new situation and it evokes new parts of my character. And so that's part of the unknown. But in some ways, a richer part is not the stuff that's totally unknown. It's the stuff that we choose not to pay attention to. That's the real meat of the internal darkness. The stuff where we're deliberate about, oh, I don't want to look at that, you know. Deliberate about not giving our attention. And it's a funny thing about the psyche. When we avoid something, we give it energy. You know? And so we get these, as it were, dragons inside. Because, you know, if we go for years, I'm not going to look at that, I'm not going to look at that, I'm not going to look at that. It's just a tremendous amount of energy goes to that thing. And so what is meant by a dragon in this context? Well, dragon is some place where our vital energy is blocked, is locked up. Another way to say it is, it's a truth. It's a truth about life or a truth about ourselves that we're not willing to face or not ready to face. Buddhism often has in its iconography, you know, for example, here with Avalokiteshvara, above him he has the, you know, the radiant Buddhas of light. And then dancing below him you have the Harukas, these fire-breathing, horrible demons who are also representing this Buddha energy. You know, and they all have halos and everything. And so it's this paradox of these completely peaceful Buddhas and then these Buddhas that look absolutely horrible, you know. And there's all kinds of explanations of, you know, why they're all the Buddha, but one of the very simple practical explanations is simply the difference between the truth you want to hear and the truth you don't want to hear. The truth you want to hear arrives as a shining Buddha. The truth you don't want to hear arrives as a demon. You know, but it's just the truth. And dragons are interesting because what a dragon is a combination of snake and bird. Snake is the ancient symbol of vitality because snakes shed their skin. And so it was thought that they had this magical ability to cast off death over and over again. Now, we realize they actually don't have that, but that was what was associated with them. In Buddhism, the Nagaraja, the snake king, was like the second in line after the Buddha in terms of holiness. And so the dragon is a snake plus, but with wings, that is, with some kind of spiritual. So it's sort of, you might say, a spiritualized vitality. That's what's represented by the dragon. And in some cultures, say the Chinese culture, the dragon is actually positive. It's, you know, represents the emperor and that sort of thing. And in the West, where they kind of had a problem with a lot of vital energies, the dragon became negative and it became something that had to be fought. But it represents fundamentally this vital energy that in some ways is stuck. The gold that it's guarding in many ways is the value that we experience by being that much more alive. When we get access to that vitality that's blocked, then the world is much more valuable. And it's as if we're seeing the world with new eyes. And so that's really the meaning of the gold. It's actually very close to the idea that the alchemists had of gold. You know, in alchemy, there were always shysters who were saying, you know, I can actually turn lead into gold. But the true alchemists were the ones who understood it wasn't about physical gold. It was about redeeming our experience. It was about transforming lead, that is to say, bad fallen human nature, into redeemed nature. And the beautiful woman is in many ways our true self. It's our core self, which is in many ways the one that we've always been longing for, you know, in so many ways. And it's so easy to get caught in the looking for that outside. It's not an experience that I can necessarily say that I completely understand, but it's been, I certainly have heard people talk of this whole idea of falling in love with oneself. And not in an egoistical sense, but in sort of an open-hearted, like really recognizing, like, I am the one I've always been longing for. That, I think, is the deep archetypal meaning of the beautiful woman that the hero rescues. And how to say it? I mean, the image of the dragon is a powerful one. And in all the hero stories, you know, there's all kinds of descriptions about how horrible the dragon is. He breathes fire and his saliva is acid and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's just, you know, the fumes kill animals that come nearby. And, you know, and it's the nature of the thing that, where we don't give our attention, and especially if we have this habit of not having given our attention to that place for a while, it's horrifying. It is horrifying to look at that very place where we've avoided for years. And the nature of the pain or the nature of the defense will send out messages like, you know, this is the worst thing imaginable. This will ruin your life if you, you know, like pain is the, how can I say, pain is the great internal PR agency. Like, it has all the answers about what you should do and basically why you should do certain things so that it can maintain its own status. It's really fascinating if you start to think of pain just as an advertising system, because it's very effective. I think one of the deep truths of human life is that we are made of love. And that every part of us, even the parts of us that are holding shame and fear and pain and grief and everything else, are made of love. And that we get at their true nature when we love them and we can unfold the love that is there. And it really is, I mean, even neurobiology now is making very clear, like, we are, in our deepest being, wired for connection. Like, that is what it is to be human more than anything else. So I'm going to share a poem. There aren't really, I mean, there are poems about darkness, but But this poem actually intrigued me in other ways. It's a poem about, the title of it is simply Lost. And it's about being lost in the woods. But it's also just a wonderful, wonderful metaphorical poem about being lost in life in general. Stand still. The trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here, and you must treat it as a powerful stranger, must ask permission to know it and be known. The forest breathes. Listen. It answers, I have made this place around you. If you leave, you may come back again, saying, here. No two trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. If what a tree or a bush does is lost on you, you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you. And it's a beautiful poem about being in nature, but it's a beautiful poem just about being lost in general. It's trusting that there's this larger teaching, that our lives are really unfolded, are woven into this larger pattern of meaning. And so that even when I'm at the point that I'm lost, that, you know, my head can't see the answer or make sense of my situation, that there's this much larger pattern that, you know, if I could just humble myself and open up to that pattern, I might be able to see it, as opposed to like thinking, oh, I have to figure it all out myself, you know, which is, of course, where we all get trapped. So I'll pass out this quote sheet. I always have a quote sheet to pass out. I used to be a teacher, so.
You still are. I always share this with a friend.
Oh, please, yes. Yeah. Take two or three, sure. So a number of quotes here. I'll just read through these. From Mr. Pliny the Elder, who died in the Vesuvius explosion. The depth of darkness to which you can descend and still live is an exact measure of the height to which you can aspire to reach. Wow. A very short one from Rumi. What hurts you blesses you. Darkness is your candle. Wow. From Meister Eckhart, the great mystic. Truly, it is in darkness that one finds the light. So when we are in sorrow, then this light is nearest of all to us. Leonardo tells us, the beginnings and ends of shadow lie between light and darkness and may be infinitely diminished and infinitely increased. Shadow is the means by which bodies display their form. The forms of bodies could not be understood in detail but for shadow. And so he's certainly talking about an artistic principle and something they talked about later, Curiosco, where it's, you know, parts are in light, parts are in darkness, and that's something that adds depth. But it's fascinating, this whole idea that this shadowy region between light and dark is where we really get this profound perspective that you don't have just in full light or full darkness. And then he also says, beyond a doubt, truth bears the same relation to falsehood as light is to darkness. Now, that's an interesting one if you combine it with the first one, that it's not what's totally true, and it's not what's totally false, but that boundary, that shady region between what's true and what's false, that's where there's the real juices in some ways. That's interesting. The great thinker Erasmus says, give light, and the darkness will disappear of itself. The artist John Ruskin says, all great and beautiful works has first come from gazing without shrinking into the darkness. rather sober one from Mark Twain, everyone is a moon and has a dark side which he never shows to anybody. From Helen Keller, everything has its wonder, even darkness and silence, and I can learn, whatever state I may in, therein to be content. Wow, from a woman whose life experience is darkness and silence. Wow. From Carl Jung, as far as we can discern, the sole purpose of human existence is to kindle a light in the darkness of mere being. And then another one from Carl Jung, a little more confronting. People will do anything, no matter how absurd, to avoid facing their own souls. One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. Kazantzaki says, the real meaning of enlightenment is to gaze with undimmed eyes on all darkness. The mystic Thomas Merton says, we stumble and fall constantly, even when we are most enlightened, but we are in true spiritual darkness when we do not even know that we have fallen. Wow. Agmanidu says, I will love the light for it shows me the way, yet I will endure the darkness because it shows me the stars. This great one from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. People are like stained glass windows. They sparkle and shine when the sun is out, but when the darkness sets in, their true beauty is revealed only if there is light from within. From Edward Abbey, you can't study the darkness by flooding it with light. From that extraordinary woman, Anne Frank, look how a single candle can both defy and define the darkness. Bishop Desmond Tutu, an extraordinary soul who is still with us. Hope is being able to see that there is light despite all of the darkness. From the current Pope, Pope Francis, from my point of view, God is the light that illuminates the darkness, even if it does not dissolve in it, and a spark of divine light is within each of us. Michael Lunig says, darkness is full of possibility. The writer Julian Cameron says, creativity, like all human life, begins in darkness. Cory Booker, who is the senator of my mother and my sister, senator from New Jersey, you've got to be one that wherever you are, like a flower, you've got to blossom where you're planted. You cannot eliminate darkness. You cannot banish it by cursing darkness. The only way to get rid of darkness is light and to be the light yourself. And from Sarah Mass, a young writer, when you spend so long trapped in darkness, you find that the darkness begins to stare back. And so that's a lot like the lost poem, like the forest staring back at you.